Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Ukrainian attacks inside Russia has stepped up in recent months. The recent drone attack on the Kremlin is the most notable. Is this part of the long-awaited Ukrainian counteroffensive? If so, what is the objective of this counteroffensive? Is it to promote a wider conflict? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guests, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst and editor at InnoSme Internet Media Project. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Well, let's start out with George in Budapest. George, you and I looked very carefully at the coverage of the drone attack on the Kremlin. Not surprising, a universal across the board, wall to wall, Russia did it to itself, okay? It's really quite interesting is that all false flags are committed by adversaries of the West. And other than that, it's a conspiracy theory to think otherwise. I think there's something much more in play here. Counteroffensive on which side, when it's going to start, May 9th. Does this add up to anything to you at this point? Go ahead, George.
Well, it's very hard to know, but you're absolutely right, Peter. False flag attacks are always what U.S. adversaries are engaged in, Syria, and then Russians, whatever, whether it's Nord Stream. They destroyed their own gas pipelines. Daria Dugina, this was obviously a Russian operation. And so that's entirely to be expected. Whereas if you say this about the United States, then you're just a crazy conspiracy theorist. So, but in terms of the counteroffensive, I think there will be a Ukrainian counteroffensive. I think it will start very shortly. I think this is a preliminary to it. Now, in terms of what its objectives are, I think it's in order to keep the war going. I don't think it hangs on whether it succeeds or succeeds slightly or doesn't succeed at all. The money's going to keep flowing in. That's the U.S. government. That's a bipartisan thing. They're just going to keep giving everything to Ukraine. So if it succeeds, then, hey, we must give them more. Look how well they're doing.
If it fails, we have to give them more.
We have to give them more because otherwise Putin wins. So either way, they get more. So, I think that's the end game behind this counteroffensive.
Dima, all of us, particularly you, we cover media very, very closely. You do all the hard work for the rest of us. Russia has always talked at. Well, give us your thoughts as a Russian about this drone attack on the Kremlin, because from my standpoint, being a resident of Moscow, it's quite humiliating, to be honest. Let's say the truth. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, it is humiliating. And of course, it's absurd when the Western politicians say that Russia did it itself. My favorite is Jürgen Trittin, a green politician from Germany, a former vice chancellor, a former Maoist, of course, in the late 60s, early 70s. He said, let me quote, "This could be the result of an internal fight inside the power apparatus of Putin." So I can just imagine, a part of Russian elite is launching the drone in order to destroy the other part of Russian elite. And then they suddenly, see it and strike it down right over the Kremlin. No, I don't think, of course, it was a false flag attack. Let's suggest it was a provocation by Russians. So then, of course, Russians, that means us, we would have prepared something terrible that would happen next hour or next 2 hours, right? A response to the attack against the Kremlin. And nothing happened. And the official announcement about the attack came, 6 or 8 hours later, because, of course, the authorities were thinking, how do you present it to the people? And if it had been a provocation, believe me, all the Russian media would be up in arms, in the next few hours, saying we must do something, Putin would make a speech, or nothing happened. So indeed, it was an attack, and Russia will respond. We don't know when, because revenge is is served cold, as the French say, right? But the mere idea of a false flag attack, you know, that you see it in all the media, in Germany, in the United States, in the UK. Didn't this very media say that false flag attacks were a typical trick of conspiracy theorists, you know? Didn't they shut down whole, you know, portals on the internet saying that they spread, you know, conspiracy theories about false flag attack and about a hidden hand, you know?
You could just use the Hunter Biden laptop, okay, if the perfect
example. Yeah, when the mainstream media in the West starts talking about Russia, it suddenly descends to the level of the most primitive conspiracy theorists, you know, like Russia is going to cut the cables in the sea, Russia destroyed its own pipeline, Russia attacked the Kremlin. You know, this is all so absurd. These people should sanction themselves.
You know, George, you know, you and I have come across this phrase. It's part of Putin's playbook, the Russian playbook. That book must be really thick. Mm-hmm. It covers all of reality, doesn't it? But more seriously, George, I think we can all say we're more or less the same age on this program. And there was something called Kremlinology, remember in the day, okay? And it got most things wrong. And it just is reared its head while people talking about Russia that basically have no idea anything about the country, because funding of Soviet studies ended the day the Soviet Union came to an end. So you basically have a group of blind mice talking about something they have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And in fact, the people to whom they go in order to get expertise on Russia have no expertise. So it's people like Julia Yoffe such people who are just simply paid to be anti-Russia.
David Fromm.
David Fromm, exactly. I mean, you know, but somebody like Julia Yoffe, who was born in Russia, I mean, her job is to be always filled with hatred for Russia. Whatever Russia does, she's on hand to tell them what a horrible, evil, terrible country it is. And, you know, it's music to the ears of the American media. But it is very interesting. I mean, exactly as Dima said, if it were a false flag attack, and the Russians did it themselves, then boom, you know, they would be immediately on hand to launch the, whatever it was that they were planning to do in the first place. And the fact that they didn't should have been evidence, obvious evidence, that it wasn't a false flag attack. And yet the stories continued, all the magazines, and, you know, they're innumerable, they're all kind of interchangeable magazines or websites, still ran for days and days that this is a false flag attack, when there's, you know, the very basis of it wasn't there at all. And so, but that's the way they present Russia.
You know, Dima, again, looking at the mainstream coverage of it, which is just, it's just pathetic, to say the least. Ukraine wouldn't do such a thing. Well, we've had assassinations ongoing. We have had bombings. We've had drone attacks here. This has been a very consistent policy. And because of the, I think it's obvious that the West, particularly the United States, is giving all the logistical intelligence help to the Ukrainians to commit these acts on Russian soil here. So, I mean, again, speaking as a Russian here, what is the reaction? Because the tempo is coming up. We're getting it more and more often here. And having particularly Daria Dugina, which is, you know, a non-combatant, okay, and having that dreadful assassination, we have that military blogger in St. Petersburg. What is the level of frustration here in dealing with this?
Alexander Kotz, you know, the famous Russian war correspondent, who is, I think, the best to cover this current conflict, and who covered also the conflict in Syria, many other countries, he says that basically this campaign of terrorist attacks on the territory of Russia is a part of that counteroffensive.
I agree.
If you look whom they strike, you know, they strike the oil depots, they strike the railroads, they strike people, you know, also well-known people, celebrities like the famous writer Zakhar Prilepin. You know, he had his car exploded, his driver died. He miraculously stayed alive, but was badly injured. And it's interesting to quote what the Western media wrote about Prilepin when he was critical of Putin in the mid-2000s. The Western media was enthusiastic about him, just like about his predecessor in literature, Edward Limonov. And Daria Dugina, because she has always been patriotic, because she has always been the way she was, they didn't spare her in any way. You know, they just, even though she was, I knew her personally, she was a very kind, nice young woman, never touched a fly in her life. And she was absolutely not aggressive. They killed her in that monstrous way. And now this attack against Prilepin. And now, you know, my sources in Ukraine and the Russian media is full of stories. The counteroffensive is starting on the Ukrainian side. They want to cut Crimea from Russia, from the rest of Russia. And I think they will fail simply because they set themselves unrealistic goals. The idea to return Crimea into Ukraine is simply not realistic. People there do not want to return to Ukraine in the first place. And also Crimea is very easy to defend geographically. And also the public opinion in Russia is absolutely, I mean, there are different views on the rest, on the central Ukraine, you know, on eastern Ukraine, but the Russian public opinion is adamant about Crimea being a part of Russia. So sanction measures to defend it.
Let me throw that to George. I mean, it's a very good point. I mean, it's impregnable. It's Russian soil. The population there doesn't want to be returned to the control of Kiev here. And so it is a very foolish, dangerous errand on the part of the Ukrainian regime. But that's just to keep the war going, as you said, right? I mean, it's an impossible goal. So we'll make some kind of attempt, and it'll just please our Western backers.
Well, without question, it will please the Western backers. We have now this congressional resolution that's working its way through Congress that demands that the U.S. support Ukraine in everything that it can do in order to restore Ukraine to its 1991 borders. So now the U.S. government will effectively be committed to Ukraine being in its 1991 borders. In effect, the U.S. government is providing a blank check to Ukraine to go for Crimea. You know, and as Dima said, I mean, that's an absolutely insane military venture, but that's not what the U.S. government is committed to. So in a way, Zelensky has to do this because that's now the official U.S. position. Right? Well, this is, you know, you have to get Crimea back. And basically, the Americans are determined to keep this war going. They're not interested in any peace talks, any peace negotiations.
On that thought, George, hold that thought. We'll talk about peace talks in the second half of the program. General, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. This is the home edition. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, let's go back to Dima here in Moscow. George brought up in the first part of the program at the very end about this congressional resolution, basically codifying. It's non-binding, but I mean, it is rhetorically very powerful, and it does influence policy to guarantee the sovereignty of Ukrainian borders of 1991. Is this a backdoor to NATO? I mean, it sounds like, you know, that's what you would give a NATO ally under the Article 5. So they're just doing extra on the side and going around NATO, because they know members of the European members of NATO would never do that. There would at least be divisions within the alliance. So this is kind of Blinken and Sullivan and Victoria Nuland doing a runaround. Go ahead.
Well, I think Lindsey Graham is also one of the authors of this resolution.
Of course, he is.
Yeah, well, Lindsey Graham had a reputation of a radical until recently, right? So the problem with the West is that radical views, which just recently were considered almost outlandish, now they're the mainstream. I mean, the official aim of the Ukrainian counteroffensive is, if we listen to people like President Macron and others, the official aim is that Ukraine should speak at negotiations from the position of force, right? Well, that's exactly what I heard. You know, I speak Polish, so that's exactly what I heard from Polish nationalists since the 90s, you know, that you can talk to Russians, but first you must assert yourself, you must give them a punch, and then you talk to them, and then they will be ready to listen to you. And this policy, I mean, this idea, which views Russia as some kind of a backward Eastern Asiatic country, Asiatic in the world, in the worst sense of the word, this policy was wrong in the 17th century already. I mean, in the United States, in the West in general, it's not fashionable to talk about the East the way Poland talks about Russia. But somehow the West adopted the Polish position, you know, not exactly the Polish, but the position of the Polish nationalists on Russia. This is a backward country that we need to talk to from a situation of strength.
I would broaden it out. I would say a lot of the Eastern European emigre community after the Second World War. This is, I think that it's kind of a culmination. George, you know, you're living in Hungary right now. I mean, you know, good reason not to like Russians, but the Hungarian government has taken a much more nuanced position. It kind of bucks history. Go ahead, George.
Right, but the Hungarian position, at least as articulated by Viktor Orban, that's not necessarily what all Hungarians think, but Orban understands that this is not 1956. I mean, there are many Hungarians who still want to wrap themselves up in 1956, much like Poland always wrapping itself in 1939. But somebody, people like Orban say, look, Soviet Union is not Russia. This isn't about Russia seeking to exert itself on non-Russian people. This is, to him, this is just a conflict between brother Slavic peoples. I mean, that's it, and it has nothing to do with us. And that's a very sophisticated position. But it's what, just going back to what Dima said about Putin only understands the language of force. This is one of the most tired cliches of Western thinking, particularly as it is quite obvious that it is wrong. I mean, it's like, you know, when you look at, say, just look at the Soviet Union, let's say in the 1950s, you have the United States threatening to roll back communism, liberate Eastern Europe. And this is tough talk. Then the Soviet Union, you know, it goes into Hungary in 1956, and the United States doesn't do anything. So much for the idea that all the Russians only understand language of force. You can threaten them, but when their vital national interests are at stake, they will do whatever it needs, and they're not interested in somebody is threatening them.
You know, and Dima, I suppose, I mean, just listening to what I hear in the media, in the Russian media and Western media and the Global South media, that is widely expected there'll be counteroffensive. Maybe the Russians and the Ukrainians will have their own counteroffensives, but obviously in different ways here. What would be the reaction? Would there be the perception that let the Ukrainians spend themselves, their forces, their, you know, their treasury, their lives, and then Russia would counter? Or because this is always reacting, and this is a long-going debate that George and I have had on our podcast, The Gaggle. You know, Russia is always reacting. It has been reacting since the start of the conflict. Yeah. Is that something that's a pretty thin argument being made now in Russia? Because again, going back to this drone attack, that's, you know, getting ready for the Victory Day parade, you know, have the, you know, I saw on CNN or something like that, you know, the camera was just miraculously there. No, those camera was there for the parade. Okay, they're getting ready for the parade. So I mean, what is the thrust of public opinion here? Is it people getting tired of reacting, or, you know, just believing in the plan? Go ahead.
Well, you're exactly right about the camera. I mean, the CNN just does know all these things. The Red Square is always filled, you know, because it's a huge, very important square symbolically. All kinds of weird things happen there, like Peter Pawlenski, that artist, you know, nailing his testicles there, and then ending up in a French psychiatric asylum. That freedom fighter, not in a Russian. Now he's in French prison, as far as I know. But anyway, what I want to say is, yes, there will be a counteroffensive. How Russia will react, I don't think even our commanders know that, because it will all depend on the situation. In general, when people say, oh, what is Putin's plan for Ukraine? I mean, things changed. But when you have military activity, you can't plan anything. You know, the aims of the wars change depending on the situation. Right. And what I can say is that I agree with George, you know, when he says that basically this policy, Putin understands only the language of strength. I mean, by all his actions, Putin has shown that he never bows to pressure. He has shown it with the terrorists in the early 2000s. He has shown it many times. You know, he can make goodwill gestures. And in general, I'm sorry, but this is typical for Russian policy. You know, there were two approaches in the West. You know, Willy Brandt, who wanted, getting closer through more contacts. And there was the position of Adenauer and the other Western politicians, like, just stay where we are and let's, you know, wait until they bog down. And Willy Brandt's policy worked. I mean, a lot of people underestimate the influence of German-Russian enabling, you know, that getting closer to each other. It was much more important than Reagan's pressure. You know, it was this that pushed Gorbachev to concessions in the mid-80s. The same thing in the East. You had Chinese approach, which was friendly. And you had Japanese approach, which was just, you know, no peace treaty. We don't move until you return us the Kuril Islands. China got its territory. You know, we have nice relations. Things are developing. Japan is where it is, you know, and where it has been 50 years ago, 60 years ago. It's the same. You know, Russia didn't move because we're not doing things under pressure. We're not doing things because you insult us. So, indeed, I think this conflict, if it shows anything, it shows that the adventurist loses. Someone who sets unrealistic aims loses. And someone who thinks that Russia would bow under pressure, that side also loses. You know, the idea that you can talk to Russia from a position of strength and that Russia would then bog down, it's simply not working. I mean, give me an example in history when it worked. There are no such examples.
You know, George, the problem is the way the West has framed this conflict in Ukraine is that it's a purity test, it's a moral, a civilizational choice and all that. That is a complete dead end, just for the reasons that Dima just enumerated. I mean, if you can't talk, you can't end it, okay? And only force will end it. That's a dreadful position to be in for particularly the soldiers in the conflict and the civilian population in Ukraine, and then the secondary elements of all of these sanctions that are impacting the global economy.
That's exactly right. I mean, the West has framed this as good versus evil. It's always Hitler. It's always Stalin. It's always a matter, you know, if we don't prevail, then evil prevails. I mean, that's
we have to fight them over there, or we have to fight them over here.
Exactly. So you know, Putin is a kind of a combination of Hitler and Stalin. It depends. It's amazing how they frame that. But the interesting thing is that when you have somebody like Macron ostensibly takes the view that, well, if we have an offensive by Ukraine, moderately successful, then we can have peace talks. And I think he probably does want to have peace talks, but it's going to be swept aside because by the Americans. The Americans, you know, in public say, yes, yes, we want peace, but they have no interest at all in peace. And they their view is that this is we have a counteroffensive. And then we move on further and further. They offer nothing to Russia. I mean, it's like, what's your offer? It's like in Godfather 2, nothing. They simply want this to go on and on. And essentially, you know, those like Macron or even Sergeant Schultz, who somehow think that, well, maybe we can, you know, get somewhere down the road and then we can have a big peace conference or whatever. They are delusional. There is no way that there's going to be anything like that. Well, this war is going to be settled by force. It's the only way it can be settled.
And importantly, George, Macron and Sergeant Schultz, they're not decision makers anymore. They're not seen as decision makers. They're actually laughed at now. They're tragic comic figures. The two most important countries in Europe have neutered themselves and handed over the baton to the loonies in Warsaw and in Kiev. Dima, jump in.
Exactly true. Unfortunately, the situation is very dangerous. The attitude which the European Union and the United States took towards Russia, it's Eurocentric in the worst sense of the word. They view Russia as some sort of other civilization, and sometimes it's binary. I mean, these people said goodbye to Christianity, but their vision of the world is dualistic, you know, in the worst sense of the word against. It's us and them. We have to prevail. And anyone who suggests a compromise, he is on the side of evil, of course, you know. This is the kind of attitude that they adopted. And I don't know what can save us, what can prevent a huge conflict. Maybe just a total failure of that Ukrainian counteroffensive, which is very possible. Because
we're rapidly running out of time here, but I've said from the beginning of this conflict, I don't know what Ukraine will look like, will be like after all this is done. But that's not the concern of Kyiv's Western backers. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.